Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 61, The Donatist Schism, Part 1. Last time, we finally saw the Great Persecution come to an end, following the defeat of its last perpetrator, Maximinus Daya. After 3 centuries of on-and-off persecution, Christianity was at long last recognized as a legal religion throughout the entire Roman Empire. In addition, Maximinus's successor in the East, Licinius, showed himself to be friendly towards his Christian subjects, despite being a pagan. And of course, the Western Emperor Constantine had embraced Christianity as his own faith. But though the persecution had ended, the early church did not come out unscathed. Schism and internal strife racked many Christian communities across the Mediterranean. We've already seen how this occurred in Egypt with the Miletian Schism, as well as the violent chaos which erupted in the Church of Rome. However, by far the worst and longest-lasting damage caused by the Great Persecution was the Schism in North Africa, a schism we have thus far not described in detail. Though we previously made reference to this conflict, today we finally turn our focus to the bitter, violent, and ultimately permanent division of the African churches known as the Donatist Schism. Following his victory over Maxentius at the Milvian Bridge, Constantine began to publicly support the Christian church, especially the clergy. During his stay in Rome over the winter of 312-313, the emperor was made aware that the property restitution issued by Maxentius the previous year was still incomplete in North Africa. Maxentius's concession of restoring the church property his father Maximian had confiscated almost a decade earlier had been belated, not properly implemented, and perhaps even reluctant. Now, though, Constantine wanted to set things right, and thus the emperor issued a series of letters to Carthage. He ordered the Proconsul of Africa to see to it that all church property was restored without delay, and then sent another law stipulating that the clergy were exempt from public services, as we discussed in a prior episode. Constantine also addressed a letter to the Bishop of Carthage, authorizing him to petition the provincial government for imperial largesse, which was to be distributed in accordance with a schedule provided by the emperor's chief ecclesiastical advisor, Osius of Cordova. What is clear from these laws is Osius, and perhaps the other leading Christians at the imperial court, had made it clear to the emperor that only those Christians belonging to the Catholic Church offered the proper worship due to the supreme divinity. It was the Orthodox, the members of the Great Church, not the Gnostics, not the Marcionites, not the Montanists, nor any other sect, who were to be the beneficiaries of this new imperial patronage. And it was to be through the leaders of the church, the bishops, that imperial support would be mainly distributed. This, of course, made the issue of who the legitimate Catholic bishop of a city was extremely important. For the man recognized as the lawful Catholic bishop, both he and his clergy were now entitled to tax and service exemptions, imperial subsidies, and legal guardianship of church property. As the narrative continues, Constantine will heap even more privileges and benefits on the clergy. The office of bishop had never been a purely religious one. Bishops have long acted like civic patrons and representatives for their communities, as we've seen in past episodes. But with the arrival of a Christian emperor on the scene, the nature of the episcopal office was transformed. So who was the Bishop of Carthage addressed in the emperor's letter? Why, it was none other than Caecilian. You remember Caecilian, don't you? He had been the archdeacon of the previous bishop, and during the Great Persecution, may or may not have attacked supporters of the confessors. As you can probably guess, Caecilian had some enemies, and it wasn't long before they petitioned the emperor. They denounced Caecilian, claiming he was not the legitimate bishop, and that their faction represented the true Catholic Christians. The emperor was not happy about the prospect of division within the church, and he took the matter seriously. For it was clear the conflict between Caecilian and his opponents was no small rupture. No, it was a schism which had come to engulf the entire African church. So how did this schism come about? To answer that, we not only need to go back almost a decade to the Great Persecution in North Africa, but even further, to the great 3rd century bishop and martyr, the church father, Cyprian of Carthage. I'm sure many of you listeners remember Cyprian of Carthage from earlier episodes, but as a refresher, here's a quick overview. Cyprian was the bishop of Carthage from 249 until his martyrdom in 258. In that decade, he led the African church through the imperial persecutions of Decius and Valerian, as well as the controversies over the lapsed and baptism. Through all this, Cyprian formulated his theology of the church. The Catholic Church was like Noah's Ark. One was either aboard it, or one was drowning in the sea of death and darkness. There was no grace beyond the visible boundaries of the Bride of Christ, and thus no salvation outside the Catholic Communion. One could not have God as their father without the Church as their mother. This meant any sacraments performed by heretics or schismatics were invalid, and converts from these communities needed to be rebaptized. How did one know they belonged to the true church? They were in communion with a bishop who himself was part of the Universal College of Brother Bishops. The bishop was the vehicle through which God's grace was distributed to believers. Bishops were sovereign in their own diocese and answerable to God alone. However, in order to be part of the College of Bishops, a man had to be pure, theologically and morally, above all suspicion. Any bishop who disgraced himself was tainted, unworthy of the priesthood, and not to be counted among the leaders of the church. The implications of this ecclesiology were rather dramatic. Since a person had to be in communion with a Catholic bishop to be part of the church and have salvation, and b, to be a Catholic bishop, that man had to be free from heresy, schism, or impurity to be part of the Universal College of Bishops, this meant that anyone in communion with a tainted bishop was outside the church, including other bishops. This stark view of the church was deeply infused into the often rigorous Christianity of the North Africans. Despite his many opponents at the time, Cyprian's own martyrdom sealed his reputation, and thus added an element of sacrosanctity to his views. Not only that, but aside from Tertullian a generation earlier, Cyprian was more or less the only major author in the African church. In contrast to, say, the Greek East, where there had been numerous influential Christian thinkers over the centuries, the churches of Africa, Numidia, and Mauritania largely looked to the writings of these two individuals, and especially Cyprian's. Moving forward now to the 4th century, we discussed in our coverage of the persecution in the West the sin of traditio, the act of handing over church property, especially the Holy Scriptures, to the imperial authorities to be burnt. For many Christians in the West, but especially in North Africa, traditio was tantamount to apostasy. One may as well offer sacrifice to an idol. Such an extreme view was not normative elsewhere, but in North Africa, it was widespread. You combine this with Cyprian's ecclesiology, and you now have, post-persecution, a lot of impure clergy running around claiming to be administering the sacraments, when in fact, they actually possessed no grace. Not only that, but any Christian who was in communion with these bishops was outside the bounds of the one true church. With that groundwork now laid, let's dive into the specific events which led to schism. You'll recall that the Bishop of Carthage at the time of the Great Persecution was Mansurius. Mansurius appears to have not been keen on the charismatic authority of the confessors. In this respect, he held to Cyprian's view that the bishop was the means through which God's grace was transmitted to the faithful. Unlike Cyprian, though, he did not handle this challenge to his authority with the same political tact. Supposedly, he instructed his archdeacon Cacilian to violently ward off pilgrims visiting the imprisoned confessors. He also cast aspersions on the motives of those Christians who volunteered themselves for martyrdom, suggesting some of them did so out of a desire to escape economic woes or become celebrities in the Christian community. Again, as we discussed in that earlier episode, there are ways to read Mansurius's actions more favorably, but many at the time did not. Mansurius was also no rigorist. He claimed to have handed over copies of heretical books when the imperial authorities came knocking. Rumors, however, abounded that this was all a sham, and that the bishop really was a traditor. Such rumors reached the ear of Mansurius's counterpart in the next-door province of Numidia, Secundus of Tagissus. Unlike Mansurius, Secundus refused to hand over anything, and so was imprisoned. After Secundus managed to be released, word reached him and his fellow Numidians of Mansurius's conduct, and the bishop of Tagissus wrote to his fellow primate asking for an explanation. Mansurius defended himself by claiming he only handed over heretical books and criticized the motives of the supposed confessors. Secundus remained friendly in his reply, but made it clear he stood with the Numidian confessors, even comparing himself to the Jewish martyr Eleazar in the Book of Maccabees. Mansurius soon found himself in another dalliance with the imperial government. One of his deacons wrote a defamatory pamphlet against the emperor, presumably either Maximian or perhaps Diocletian. When the authorities came to arrest him, the deacon fled to his bishop's home. Mansurius refused to give the man up, and so the authorities summoned him in place of the deacon. It seems Mansurius was fearful the remaining property of the Church of Carthage would be seized by the imperial fisc if his summons didn't end well. The church's property consisted not just of lands, but significant amounts of movable wealth in gold and silver plate. This movable wealth was what was at issue, since the government had seized all church lands in accordance with Diocletian's edict. So Mansurius entrusted it all to the signores, or elders, not the presbytery, but rather senior laymen, akin to a modern-day parish council, but with greater civic prestige and ecclesiastical influence. However, hinting that the bishop was not completely trusting of the signores, Mansurius also took a complete inventory of the items and secretly entrusted it to an old Christian woman. Mansurius instructed her that, should anything happen to him, she was to hand this list over to whoever became the next bishop of Carthage. Mansurius then went to the palace, either an imperial one in Italy or the palace of the proconsul, where it seems he adequately pleaded his defense and was ordered to return. However, the bishop died before making it back home, leaving the Church of Carthage without a leader and the Christians of proconsular Africa without a primate. Active persecution in the West petered out after 304, and all but ended with the joint abdication of Diocletian and Maximian in May of 305. However, official peace did not come until late 306, when you'll remember, after Maxentius came to power, he issued his edict of toleration in order to garner the political support of the Christians. In the uneasy interval between, a council was held in the city of Cirta, the capital of northern Numidia. The occasion for this was to consecrate the new bishop of the city. You may remember that the previous bishop of Cirta, Paul, was a traditor. He and his clergy had cooperated with the authorities by handing over church plate and clothing for the poor. In the wake of Paul's death, the Christians of Cirta were divided. The more upper-class citizens wanted an honest man of respectable character. However, they were overruled by the more fanatical lower classes, who locked them up in a funerary chapel dedicated to the martyrs. The man they selected was none other than the subdeacon Silvanus. You may remember that Silvanus had cooperated with Bishop Paul in handing over church plate to the imperial authorities, making Silvanus also a traditor. However, this fact, which appears to have been widely known, did not assuage the mob from electing him bishop. Silvanus himself made a mocking reference to this deed later in the local church building. The reasons for Silvanus's acceptance are not clear. One would think the more zealous lower classes would take greater issue with traditio than the upper-class Christians who oppose Silvanus. Historian William Friend suggests Silvanus had restored his reputation by associating himself with the notorious bishop Purpurius of Limata. Purpurius of Limata was a violent, murderous brigand who, with Silvanus, had robbed pagan temples. Friend suggests that this thievery was motivated by popular anti-pagan and anti-imperial sentiment aroused by the Great Persecution. With the opposition intimidated and barred, Silvanus was hoisted aloft by gladiators and accompanied by prostitutes during his acclamation to the Holy Order of Bishop. To top it all off, Silvanus' first official action was to receive a bribe from a man named Victor in exchange for the office of presbyter. The mobs of Cirta having made their selection, a synod of the required 12 bishops was convened to formally perform the consecration. The council met on May 5th, either in 305 or, more likely, 306, the exact year is uncertain. The chair of the Council of Cirta was, of course, Secundus of Tigisus. Also among the bishops were Secundus's nephew, also named Secundus, and Purpurius of Limata. Per the Ecclesiology of Cyprian, the bishops had to be in a state of grace in order to validly perform the sacrament of ordination. Secundus asked each man to give an account of himself. Many of the bishops present were accused of traditio, and indeed, many confessed before Secundus to having handed over the scriptures. However, when Secundus turned to Purpurius, he brought forth the charge that the bishop of Limata had murdered his nephews. Purpurius responded by saying he would not be intimidated by the primate like the others. Instead, he threw a charge back at Secundus. The bishop of Tigisus had been imprisoned during the persecution, but had somehow managed to secure his release. Surely he must have done something compromising to earn his get-out-of-jail-free card. Purpurius furthermore admitted he had committed murder, and swore he would do so again should anyone act against him. The younger Secundus saw in this threat the possibility of schism, and advised his uncle to drop the interrogations. The possibility of schism was an outcome to be avoided at this juncture. Following the views of Cyprian, Secundus relented and agreed the bishops assembled would be accountable to God alone for their deeds. With the matter settled, the synod proceeded to consecrate Silvanus, bishop of Cirta. Silvanus, in turn, gave the bishops the bribe he had received from the soon-to-be-ordained presbyter, Victor. Sometime after the Council of Cirta, Maxentius seized power in Rome, and in late 306, he formally decreed toleration for the Christians of Italy and Africa. As we saw in a previous episode, this led to schism and factional violence in the Church of Rome. The Roman Christians had declined to elect a new bishop following the death of the compromised Marcellinus. When peace resumed, it set off a series of rival papal claimants between the rigorous and moderate camps. Now it is time to see how this dynamic played out in Africa, with the contested election in Carthage, which resulted in the Donatist Schism. There is some disagreement over when the election of the new Bishop of Carthage occurred. Traditionally, the year 311 has been preferred, placing the schism closer in time to Constantine's victory at the Milvian Bridge. This chronology also requires the summons and death of Mansurius to have occurred in 311 as well. However, more recent scholarship has preferred a longer chronology, with an early date of around 307, shortly after the official end of the persecution in the West. Much of this depends on which tyrannical emperor Mansurius's deacon wrote a defamatory pamphlet against. The traditional chronology identifies the tyrant as Maxentius. However, more recent scholarship favors Maximian or Diocletian, the perpetrators of the Great Persecution. This identification appears to be correct, and as such, I will be following the longer chronology. Probably around early 307, the members of the Church of Carthage began looking at candidates for the episcopacy. Among the interested parties were the signores, whom we mentioned earlier. However, their aims were far more self-interested. It turns out Mansurius had been right to be suspicious of them when he entrusted the movable wealth of the church to their care. Why? Well, because the signores had decided to plunder the wealth for themselves. Now it appeared their sin would come to light if they didn't get their man on the bishop's throne. However, the signores failed to agree upon a suitable candidate in time. Church custom made for a short timeline. For a while, there had been a custom of having the primate of Numidia ordain his counterpart in Carthage. This was, however, not the only custom in the early church, and many other Christian communities had their bishops consecrated by other bishops of the local province. Two clerics named Bostrus and Celestius both desired to be made bishop, and so conspired to make sure the consecration took place before the Numidian synod arrived, meaning only local bishops would be involved. The consecrating bishops brought to Carthage numbered three in total, two from proconsular Africa, and the third from Byzacena. This last man was none other than Felix of Apthugni. As a refresher, Felix of Apthugni was rumored to be a traditor, because he was alleged to have collaborated with the city magistrate by directing his congregation to assist the authorities in handing over the scriptures. However, these rumors were not of concern yet for the Carthaginian Christians, including Bostrus, Celestius, and the signores. All that changed, however, when the citizen body of Carthage hailed the Archdeacon Cacilian as the new bishop. After Felix and the other two bishops ordained him, Cacilian took his place on the bishop's chair, and the trusted elderly woman, who had been given the inventory by Mensurius, dutifully handed the document over to his successor. Cacilian then asked the signores to turn over the movable wealth of the church to him. Their greed now exposed, the signores withdrew from communion with the new bishop, an act in which they were joined by the jilted Bostrus and Celestius. Adding to the opposition to Cacilian was the third factor, the wealthy and influential Spanish matron, Lucilla, whose household was among the leading members of the Church of Carthage. Lucilla's beef with Cacilian preceded even the Great Persecution. During worship one Sunday morning, Lucilla kissed the bone of a martyr before kissing the communion chalice. Cacilian, then still Mensurius's archdeacon, rebuked her for showing such veneration to a supposed martyr before paying due honor to the cup of Christ. Like Mensurius, Cacilian appears to have been hostile towards the ever-growing popularity of the cult of martyrs. These sentiments were said to be confirmed by his later willingness to follow Mensurius's orders to harass the pilgrims visiting the confessors at Abitina. Lucilla, Bostrus, Celestius, and the signores came together in opposition to Cacilian, taking a decent chunk of the city's Christian populace with them. Whereas Bostrus and Celestius had formerly feared Numidian intervention, now they realized that their support could be crucial in deposing Cacilian. Secundus of Tagissus had been informed of events and was on his way with 70 Numidian bishops in tow, including the infamous Papirius of Limata. When the Numidians arrived in Carthage, they were greeted warmly by the anti-Cacilianist opposition, while in contrast, the pro-Cacilianists of the city did not offer hospitality. Instead, they gathered to Cacilian in the local church. The enemies of Cacilian made their case to Secundus and brought the Numidians firmly into their camp. Not only had Cacilian ignored the custom of letting himself be ordained by the primate of Numidia, and not only had it been three instead of the traditional 12 bishops who performed the ordination, but worst of all, one of the bishops who consecrated Cacilian was a traditor, Felix of Apthugni. This last charge was the crucial factor which wrought the schism. Following the ecclesiology of Cyprian, any sacrament performed by a traditor, ordination among them, was invalid. Combine this with popular animosity towards traditores and Cacilian's own checkered past with the martyrs and confessors, and you have the basis for much groundswell support against the new bishop. Cacilian was ordained by a traditor, a man who betrayed Christ and the scriptures, instead of remaining steadfast like the confessors and martyrs. This, of course, made perfect sense to many. Of course, that awful Cacilian had no problem with Felix ordaining him. Cacilian was an enemy of God's martyrs and confessors. Didn't you hear what he did to Lucilla, or to those who visited the confessors at Abitina? Didn't the holy confessors and martyrs say that any traditor and those in league with them were cut off from the true people of God? Didn't the great father and martyr Cyprian teach us that bishops are accountable to God alone and so must be absolutely pure? Didn't the great Cyprian also teach us that outside the true church there is no grace, no sacraments? Things did not, however, result in schism right away. Secundus treated Caecilian's ordination as a matter pending further investigation. For the time being, the Numidians appointed an interventor, or acting bishop, to take over Caecilian's duties, until a church council had made a final decision. Unfortunately for this interventor, there were apparently some in Carthage who were willing to defend Caecilian's episcopate by any means necessary. The man was soon found dead in the local house church, and the Caecilianists were blamed for his murder. This bloodshed ramped up tensions between the two camps a hundredfold. To finally settle the matter, Secundus and the 70 Numidian bishops gathered together in a formal council and invited Caecilian to attend what was, effectively, an episcopal trial. Caecilian refused and instead affirmed the Cyprianic ecclesiology that all bishops were equal before God. If Secundus had an issue with him, he could come to the local church to discuss it. Secundus, however, was too smart to fall for this. Going to visit Caecilian in the church building would have effectively conceded that Caecilian was the legitimate bishop of Carthage. A deadlock thus ensued. However, it was after this that Caecilian himself made a crucial mistake. He informed the Numidians that if they found fault in his ordination by Felix of Bethugni, he would allow himself to be reconsecrated by them. Why was this such a critical error on Caecilian's part? Because in acknowledging their objection to Felix ordaining him, he essentially conceded the entire issue. That being ordained by a traditor meant one's ordination was invalid. This was the crux of the whole dispute. Outside of North Africa, many Christians would not have agreed with Cyprian's theology of the church. No man was worthy to perform the sacraments. It was God, in his love and mercy for his people, that made bishops and presbyters worthy to serve at his altar and in his church. The personal sinfulness of a cleric did not impinge on this, and did not therefore determine if a sacrament was valid. This was, of course, the more inclusive model of the Christian church. Not Noah's Ark, not a city on a hill composed of the pure, but a mixed body of saints and sinners. However, the theological underpinnings of all this were largely lost as the schism unfolded. For now, everyone was focused on the particulars of Caecilian's ordination. Caecilian's admission that consecration by a traditor was invalid in his offer to be reordained was met with a wholly negative response. Purpurius of Lamata, refusing to temper his violent fanaticism, responded to the offer by threatening to crush Caecilian's skull during the laying on of hands ritual. More importantly, Secundus and the council proceeded to condemn and depose Caecilian, not only on his illegitimate consecration, but also his behavior towards the martyrs at Abitina during the persecution. The man chosen to replace him was a member of Lucilla's household, the reader Major Rhinus, whose nomination was allegedly accepted after Lucilla bribed the synod. Embassies were then dispatched to Rome, Spain, and Gaul, relaying the council's decision. Their business now concluded, the Numidians packed up and returned home. Thus, there were now two bishops in Carthage, Caecilian and Major Rhinus, with each commanding a competing faction of supporters. As one of our sources puts it, altar was raised against altar. The Church of Carthage, the home of great Christian figures like Tertullian, Perpetua, and Cyprian, was from that day forward forever divided. In no short amount of time, the fires of schism spread beyond the city and engulfed all of Africa. Christians, laity and clergy, were rebaptized by Major Rhinus and his followers, the Donatists. The Donatists would come to regard themselves as the heirs of the martyrs and confessors. Like the Miletians in Egypt, they would call themselves the Church of the Martyrs, and brand the Caecilianists and their allies as the Church of the Traditores. They were Israel, while their opponents were the Canaanites, or they were Judah, loyal to the house of David, while the others followed Caecilian, like northern Israel followed King Jeroboam. Now, I bet many of you are wondering at this point, why do we refer to this as the Donatist schism? Where in the world does the name Donatist come from? Well, as I'm sure some of you have guessed, it comes from a person's name. Major Rhinus will not last long, and by the middle of 313, he will die and be succeeded by Donatus of Casae Nigrae. The opponents of Caecilian will not win the recognition of the church at large. The Caecilianists will be seen as the Catholics, and the Donatists, the supporters of first Major Rhinus and then Donatists, will be branded as schismatics by the church in the time-honored tradition of referring to heretics and schismatics after their founder. So, who was this founder of the Donatist church? Donatus originated from the city of Casae Nigrae, or the Black House in Latin. This settlement was located on the southern end of Numidia, and the Christians there had been severely oppressed by the zealously anti-Christian governor Florus during the persecution. It seems Donatus was already an ardent rigorist before he moved north to Carthage. Once in Carthage, he became an opponent of Mansurius, and following the election, a determined foe of Caecilian. It has been suggested that it was Donatist who kept the Numidian bishops informed on events before their arrival in the city. Donatus himself would prove to be a powerful figure in North Africa. A man of forceful personality and personal integrity, whose oratorical and leadership skills were second to none. He would end up leading the Donatist church for some 40 years. His followers would remember him as Donatus Magnus, Donatus the Great, and the movement would come to be named after him by its opponents. However, at this time, Donatus was just one of the rising stars in the anti-Caecilianist faction. This now brings us back to where we started this episode. Following the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, a newly converted emperor now ruled North Africa. Constantine began doling out privileges and largesse to the Church of Carthage and its bishop, Caecilian. However, he soon received a letter from the proconsul informing the Augustus of the schism, as well as a petition from the supporters of Major Rhinus and a sealed list of charges against Caecilian. The emperor was, to put it one way, not exactly thrilled about this. Next episode, we will see how Constantine and the Western Church as a whole reacts to the situation in North Africa. The sequence of events which follows will test the waters of the burgeoning relationship between church and throne, setting new precedents for how a Christian emperor should handle division within the church. Constantine was about to discover that, far from being a perfectly unified corporate body, the Christian church was a seething cauldron of potential division and controversy.